Chapter 25. The Traveling People. Bella walked along placidly under the weak sun, as if the three wolves trotting not far off were only village dogs. But the way she rolled her eyes at them from time to time, showing white all the way around, indicated she felt nothing of the sort. Egwene on the mare's back was just as bad. She watched the wolves constantly from the corner of her eye, and sometimes she twisted in the saddle to look around. Perrin was sure she was hunting for the rest of the pack, though she denied it angrily when he suggested as much, denied being afraid of the wolves that paced them, denied worrying about the rest of the pack or what it was up to. She denied and went right on looking, tied-eyed and wetting her lips uneasily. The rest of the pack was far distant. He could have told her that. What good, even if she believed me, especially if she did? He was of no mind to open that basket of snakes until he had to. He did not want to think about how he knew. The fur-clad man loped ahead of them, sometimes looking almost like a wolf himself, and he never looked around when Dapple Hopper and the wind appeared, but he knew too. The Emmonsfielders had wakened at dawn that first morning to find Elias cooking more rabbit and watching them over his full beard without much expression. Except for Dapple, Hopper, and Wind, no wolves were to be seen. In the pale early daylight, deep shade still lingered under the big oak, and the bare trees beyond looked like fingers stripped to the bone.
"They're around," Elias answered when Egwene asked where the rest of the pack had gone. "Close enough to help, if need be. Far enough off to avoid any human trouble we get into. Sooner or later, there's always trouble when there's two humans together. If we need them, they'll be there."
Something tickled the back of Perrin's mind as he ripped free a bite of roast rabbit. A direction vaguely sensed. Of course, that's where they... The hot juices in his mouth abruptly lost all taste. He picked at the tubers Elias had cooked in the coals. They tasted something like turnips, but his appetite was gone. When they had started out, Egwene insisted that everyone take a turn riding, and Perrin did not even bother to argue.
"First turn is yours," he told her. She nodded. "And then you, Elias."
"My own legs are good enough for me," Elias said.
He looked at Bella, and the mare rolled her eyes as if he were one of the wolves.
"Besides, I don't think she wants me riding her."
"That's nonsense," Egwene replied firmly. "There is no point in being stubborn about it. The sensible thing is for everybody to ride sometimes. According to you, we have a long way still to go."
"I said no, girl."
She took a deep breath, and Perrin was wondering if she would succeed in bullying Elias the way she did him, when he realized she was standing there with her mouth open, not saying a word. Elias was looking at her, just looking, with those yellow wolf's eyes. Egwene stepped back from the raw-boned man and licked her lips, and stepped back again. Before Elias turned away, she had backed all the way to Bella and scrambled up onto the mare's back. As the man turned to lead them south, Perrin thought his grin was a good deal like a wolf's, too. For 3 days they traveled in that manner, walking and riding south and east all day, stopping only when twilight thickened. Elias seemed to scorn the haste of city men, but he did not believe in wasting time when there was somewhere to go. The three wolves were seldom seen. Each night they came to the fire for a time, and sometimes in the day they showed themselves briefly, appearing close at hand when least expected, and vanishing in the same manner. Perrin knew they were out there, though, and where. He knew when they were scouting the path ahead, and when they were watching the back trail. He knew when they left the pack's usual hunting grounds, and Dapple sent the pack back to wait for her. Sometimes the three that remained faded from his mind, but long before they were close enough to see again, he was aware of them returning. Even when the trees dwindled to wide scattered groves separated by great swaths of winter-dead grass, they were as ghosts when they did not want to be seen. But he could have pointed a finger straight at them at any time. He did not know how he knew, and he tried to convince himself that it was just his imagination playing tricks, but it did no good. Just as Elias knew, he knew. He tried not thinking about wolves, but they crept into his thoughts all the same. He had not dreamed about Balsamon since meeting Elias and the wolves. His dreams, as much as he remembered of them on waking, were of everyday things, just as he might have dreamed at home,
before Bearlon, before winter night. Normal dreams, with one addition. In every dream, he remembered there was a point where he straightened from Master Luhan's forge to wipe the sweat from his face, or turned from dancing with the village girls on the green, or lifted his head from a book in front of the fireplace, and whether he was outside or under a roof, there was a wolf close to hand. Always the wolf's back was to him, and always he knew, in the dreams it seemed the normal course of things, even at Alsbet Luhan's dinner table, that the wolf's yellow eyes were watching for what might come, guarding against what might come. Only when he was awake did the dreams seem strange. 3 days they journeyed, with Dapple, Hopper, and Wind bringing them rabbits and squirrels, and Elias pointing out plants, few of which Perrin recognized, as good to eat. Once a rabbit burst out, almost from under Bella's hooves. Before Perrin could get a stone in his sling, Elias skewered it with his long knife at 20 paces. Another time Elias brought down a fat pheasant on the wing with his bow. They ate far better than they had when on their own, but Perrin would as soon have gone back on short rations if it had meant different company. He was not sure how Egwene felt, but he would have been willing to go hungry if he could do it without the wolves. 3 days into the afternoon. A stand of trees lay ahead, larger than most they had seen, a good 4 miles across. The sun sat low in the western sky, pushing slanted shadows off to their right, and the wind was picking up. Perrin felt the wolves give over quartering behind them and start forward, not hurrying. They had smelled and seen nothing dangerous. Egwene was taking her turn on Bella. It was time to start looking for a camp for the night, and the big copse would serve the purpose well. As they came close to the trees, 3 mastiffs burst from cover, broad-muzzled dogs as tall as the wolves and even heavier, teeth bared in loud rumbling snarls. They stopped short as soon as they were in the open, but no more than 30 feet separated them from the 3 people, and their dark eyes kindled with a killing light. Bella, already on edge from the wolves, whinnied and almost unseated Egwene, but Perrin had his sling whirling around his head in an instant. No need to use the axe on dogs. A stone in the ribs would send the worst dog running. Elias waved a hand at him without taking his eyes from the stiff-legged dogs.
Hist! None of that now.
Perrin gave him a puzzled frown, but let the sling slow its spin and finally fall to his side. Egwene managed to get Bella under control. She and the mare both watched the dogs warily. The mastiff's hackles stood stiff, and their ears were laid back, and their growls sounded like earthquakes. Abruptly, Elias raised one finger shoulder high and whistled, a long, shrill whistle that rose higher and higher and did not end. The growls cut off raggedly. The dogs stepped back, whining and turning their heads as if they wanted to go, but were held. Their eyes remained locked to Elias's finger. Slowly, Elias lowered his hand, and the pitch of his whistle lowered with it. The dogs followed until they lay flat on the ground, their tongues lolling from their mouths. 3 tails wagged.
See, Elias said, walking to the dogs. There's no need for weapons.
The mastiffs licked his hands, and he scratched their broad heads and fondled their ears.
They look meaner than they are. They meant to frighten us off, and they wouldn't have bitten unless we tried to go into the trees. Anyway, there's no worry of that now. We can make the next thicket before full dark.
When Perrin looked at Egwene, her mouth was hanging open. He shut his own mouth with a click of teeth. Still patting the dogs, Elias studied the stand of trees.
There'll be Tuatha on here. The traveling people.
They stared at him blankly, and he added, Tinkers.
Tinkers? Perrin exclaimed. I've always wanted to see the Tinkers. They camp across the river from Taran Ferry sometimes, but they don't come down into the 2 rivers, as far as I know. I don't know why not.
Egwene sniffed.
Probably because the Taran Ferry folk are as great thieves as the Tinkers. They'd no doubt end up stealing each other blind. Master Elias, if there really are Tinkers close by, shouldn't we go on? We don't want Bella stolen, and... Well, we do not have much else, but everybody knows Tinkers will steal anything.
Including infants? Elias asked dryly. Kidnap children and all that? He spat, and she blushed. Those stories about babies were told sometimes, but most often by Sen Bui or one of the Coplins or Congers. The other tales everybody knew. The Tinkers make me sick sometimes, but they don't steal any more than most folks. A good bit less than some, I know.
It will be getting dark soon, Elias, Perrin said. We have to camp somewhere. Why not with them, if they'll have us?
Mistress Luhan had a tinker-mended pot that she claimed was better than new. Master Luhan was not too happy about his wife's praise of the tinker work, but Perrin wanted to see how it was done. Yet there was a reluctance about Elias that he did not understand.
Is there some reason we shouldn't?
Elias shook his head, but the reluctance was still there in the set of his shoulders and the tightness of his mouth.
May as well. Just don't pay any mind to what they say. A lot of foolishness. Most times the traveling people do things any which way. But there's times they set a store by formality. So you'd do what I do. And keep your secrets. No need to tell the world everything.
The dogs trailed along beside them, wagging their tails as Elias led the way into the trees. Perrin felt the wolves slow and knew they would not enter. They were not afraid of the dogs. They were contemptuous of dogs, who had given up freedom to sleep by a fire. But people they avoided. Elias walked surely, as if he knew the way. And near the center of the stand, the tinker's wagons appeared, scattered among the oak and ash. Like everyone else in Emmonsfield, Perrin had heard a good deal about the tinkers, even if he had never seen any, and the camp was just what he expected. Their wagons were small houses on wheels, tall wooden boxes, lacquered and painted in bright colors, reds and blues and yellows and greens, and some hues to which he could not put a name. The traveling people were going about work that was disappointingly every day, cooking, sewing, tending children, mending harness, but their clothes were even more colorful than the wagons, and seemingly chosen at random. Sometimes coat and breeches, or dress and shawl, went together in a way that hurt the eyes. They looked like butterflies in a field of wild flowers. 4 or 5 men in different places around the camp played fiddles and flutes, and a few people danced like rainbow-hued hummingbirds. Children and dogs ran playing among the cook fires. The dogs were mastiffs, just like those that had confronted the travelers, but the children tugged at their ears and tails and climbed on their backs, and the massive dogs accepted it all placidly. The three with Elias, tongues hanging out, looked up at the bearded man as if he were their best friend. Perrin shook his head. They were still big enough to reach a man's throat while barely getting their front feet off the ground. Abruptly, the music stopped, and he realized all the tinkers were looking at him and his companions. Even the children and dogs stood still and watched, warily, as if on the point of flight. For a moment, there was no sound at all. Then a wiry man, gray-haired and short, stepped forward and bowed gravely to Elias. He wore a high-collared red coat and baggy, bright green trousers tucked into knee boots.
"You are welcome to our fires. Do you know the song?"
Elias bowed in the same way, both hands pressed to his chest.
"Your welcome warms my spirit, Mahdi, as your fires warm the flesh. But I do not know the song."
"Then we seek still," the gray-haired man intoned. "As it was, so shall it be, if we but remember, seek, and find."
He swept an arm toward the fires with a smile, and his voice took on a cheerful lightness.
"The meal is almost ready. Join us, please."
As if that had been a signal, the music sprang up again, and the children took up their laughter and ran with the dogs. Everyone in the camp went back to what they had been doing, just as though the newcomers were long-accepted friends. The gray-haired man hesitated, though, and looked at Elias.
"Your other friends? They will stay away? They frightened the poor dog so."
"They'll stay away, Rain." Elias's headshake had a touch of scorn. "You should know that by now."
The gray-haired man spread his hands as if to say nothing was ever certain. As he turned to lead them into the camp, Egwene dismounted and moved close to Elias.
You two are friends?
A smiling tinker appeared to take Bella. Egwene gave the reins up reluctantly after a wry snort from Elias.
We know each other, the fur-clad man replied curtly.
His name is Mahdi, Perrin said.
Elias growled something under his breath.
His name's Rain. Mahdi's his title. Seeker. He's the leader of this band. You can call him Seeker if the other sounds odd. He won't mind.
What was that about a song? Egwene asked.
That's why they travel, Elias said, or so they say. They're looking for a song. That's what the Mahdi seeks. They say they lost it during the breaking of the world, and if they can find it again, the paradise of the Age of Legends will return.
He ran his eye around the camp and snorted.
They don't even know what the song is. They claim they'll know it when they find it. They don't know how it's supposed to bring paradise either, but they've been looking near to 3,000 years ever since the breaking. I expect they'll be looking until the wheel stops turning.
They reached Rain's fire, then, in the middle of the camp. The Seeker's wagon was yellow, trimmed in red, and the spokes of its tall, red-rimmed wheels alternated red and yellow. A plump woman, as gray as Rain, but smooth-cheeked still, came out of the wagon and paused on the steps at its back end, straightening a blue-fringed shawl on her shoulders. Her blouse was yellow and her skirt red, both bright. The combination made Perrin blink, and Egwene made a strangled sound. When she saw the people following Rain, the woman came down with a welcoming smile. She was Ila, Rain's wife, a head taller than her husband, and she soon made Perrin forget about the colors of her clothes. She had a motherliness that reminded him of Mistress Alvire and had him feeling welcome from her first smile. Ila greeted Elias as an old acquaintance, but with a distance that seemed to pain Rain. Elias gave her a dry grin and a nod. Perrin and Egwene introduced themselves, and she clasped their hands in both of hers with much more warmth than she had shown Elias, even hugging Egwene.
"Why, you're a lovely child," she said, cupping Egwene's chin and smiling. "And chilled to the bone, too, I expect. You sit close to the fire, Egwene. All of you sit. Supper is almost ready."
Fallen logs had been pulled around the fire for sitting. Elias refused even that concession to civilization. He lounged on the ground instead. Iron tripods held two small kettles over the flames, and an oven rested in the edge of the coals. Ila tended them. As Perrin and the others were taking their places, a slender young man wearing green stripes strolled up to the fire. He gave Rain a hug and Ila a kiss, and ran a cool eye over Elias and the Emmons Fielders. He was about the same age as Perrin, and he moved as if he were about to begin dancing with his next step.
"Well, Aram," Ila smiled fondly, "you have decided to eat with your old grandparents for a change, have you?"
Her smile slid over to Egwene as she bent to stir a kettle hanging over the cook fire.
"I wonder why."
Aram settled to an easy crouch, with his arms crossed on his knees across the fire from Egwene.
"I am Aram," he told her in a low, confident voice.
He no longer seemed aware that anyone was there except her.
"I have waited for the first rose of spring, and now I find it at my grandfather's fire."
Perrin waited for Egwene to snicker, then saw that she was staring back at Aram. He looked at the young tinker again. Aram had more than his share of good looks, he admitted. After a minute, Perrin knew who the fellow reminded him of.
Will Alcine, who had all the girls staring and whispering behind his back whenever he came up from Devon Ride to Emmons Field.
Will courted every girl in sight and managed to convince every one of them that he was just being polite to all the others.
"Those dogs of yours," Perrin said loudly, and Egwene gave a start. "Look as big as bears. I'm surprised you let the children play with them."
Aram's smile slipped, but when he looked at Perrin, it came back again, even more sure than before. They will not harm you. They make a show to frighten away danger and warn us, but they are trained according to the way of the leaf.
The way of the leaf? Egwene said. What is that?
Aram gestured to the trees, his eyes fastened intently on hers.
The leaf sits its appointed time and does not struggle against the wind that carries it away. The leaf does no harm, and finally falls to nourish new leaves. So it should be with all men and women.
Egwene stared back at him, a faint blush rising in her cheeks.
But what does that mean? Perrin said.
Aram gave him an irritated glance, but it was Rain who answered. It means that no man should harm another for any reason whatsoever.
The Seeker's eyes flickered to Elias.
There is no excuse for violence. None. Not ever.
What if somebody attacks you? Perrin insisted. What if somebody hits you or tries to rob you or kill you?
Rain sighed, a patient sigh, as if Perrin was just not seeing what was so clear to him.
If a man hit me, I would ask him why he wanted to do such a thing. If he still wanted to hit me, I would run away, as I would if he wanted to rob or kill me. Much better that I let him take what he wanted, even my life, than that I should do violence. And I would hope that he was not harmed too greatly.
But you said you wouldn't hurt him, Perrin said.
I would not. But violence harms the one who does it as much as the one who receives it.
Perrin looked doubtful.
You could cut down a tree with your axe, Rain said. The axe does violence to the tree and escapes unharmed. Is that how you see it? Wood is soft compared to steel. But the sharp steel is dulled as it chops, and the sap of the tree will rust and pit it. The mighty axe does violence to the helpless tree and is harmed by it. So it is with men, though the harm is in the spirit.
But...
Enough, Elias growled, cutting Perrin off. Rain, it's bad enough you're trying to convert village younglings to that nonsense. It gets you in trouble almost everywhere you go, doesn't it? But I didn't bring this lot here for you to work on them. Leave over.
And leave them to you,
Ela said, grinding herbs between her palms and letting them trickle into one of the kettles. Her voice was calm, but her hands rubbed the herbs furiously.
Will you teach them your way, to kill or die? Will you lead them to the fate you seek for yourself, dying alone with only the ravens and your friends to squabble over your body?
Be at peace, Ela, Rain said gently, as if he had heard this all and more 100 times.
He has been welcomed to our fire, my wife.
Ela subsided, but Perrin noticed that she made no apology. Instead, she looked at Elias and shook her head sadly, then dusted her hands and began taking spoons and pottery bowls from a red chest on the side of the wagon. Rain turned back to Elias.
My old friend, how many times must I tell you that we do not try to convert anyone? When village people are curious about our ways, we answer their questions.
It is most often the young who ask, true, and sometimes one of them will come with us when we journey on. But it is of their own free will.
You tried telling that to some farm wife who's just found out her son or daughter has run off with you tinkers, Elias said wryly. That's why the bigger towns won't even let you camp nearby. Villages put up with you for your mending things, but the cities don't need it, and they don't like you talking their young folks into running off.
I would not know what the cities allow.
Rain's patience seemed inexhaustible. He certainly did not appear to be getting angry at all.
There are always violent men in cities. In any case, I do not think the song could be found in a city.
I don't mean to offend you, Seeker, Perrin said slowly, but, well, I don't look for violence. I don't think I've even wrestled anybody in years except for feast day games. But if somebody hit me, I'd hit him back. If I didn't, I would just be encouraging him to think he could hit me whenever he wanted to.
Some people think they can take advantage of others, and if you don't let them know they can't, they'll just go around bullying anybody weaker than they are.
Some people, Aram said with a heavy sadness, can never overcome their baser instincts.
He said it with a look at Perrin that made it clear he was not talking about the bullies Perrin spoke of.
I'll bet you get to run away a lot, Perrin said.
And the young tinker's face tightened in a way that had nothing to do with the way of the leaf.
I think it is interesting, Egwene said, glaring at Perrin, to meet someone who doesn't believe his muscles can solve every problem.
Aram's good spirits returned, and he stood, offering her his hands with a smile.
Let me show you our camp. There is dancing. I would like that.
She smiled back. Ila straightened from taking loaves of bread from the small iron oven.
But supper is ready, Aram. I'll eat with mother,
Aram said over his shoulder, as he drew Egwene away from the wagon by her hand.
We will both eat with mother.
He flashed a triumphant smile at Perrin. Egwene was laughing as they ran. Perrin got to his feet, then stopped. It was not as if she could come to any harm, not if the camp followed this way of the leaf, as Rain said. Looking at Rain and Ila, both staring dejectedly after their grandson, he said,
I'm sorry. I am a guest, and I shouldn't have... Don't be foolish, Ila said soothingly. It was his fault, not yours. Sit down and eat. Aram is a troubled young man, Rain added sadly. He is a good boy, but sometimes I think he finds the way of the leaf a hard way. Some do, I fear. Please, my fire is yours. Please?
Perrin sat back down slowly, still feeling awkward.
What happens to somebody who can't follow the way? He asked. A tinker, I mean.
Rain and Ila exchanged a worried look, and Rain said,
They leave us. The lost go to live in the villages.
Ila stared in the direction her grandson had gone.
The lost cannot be happy.
She sighed, but her face was placid again when she handed out the bowls and spoons. Perrin stared at the ground, wishing he had not asked, and there was no more talk while Ila filled their bowls with the thick vegetable stew and handed out thick slices of her crusty bread, nor while they ate. The stew was delicious, and Perrin finished three bowls before he stopped. Elias, he noted with a grin, emptied four. After the meal, Rain filled his pipe, and Elias produced his own and stuffed it from Rain's oilskin pouch. When the lighting and tamping and relighting were done, they settled back in silence. Ila took out a bundle of knitting. The sun was only a blaze of red above the treetops to the west. The camp had settled in for the night, but the bustle did not slow, only changed. The musicians who had been playing when they entered the camp had been replaced by others, and even more people than before danced in the light of the fires, their shadows leaping against the wagons. Somewhere in the camp, a chorus of male voices rose. Perrin slid down in front of the log and soon felt himself dozing.
After a time, Rain said, Have you visited any of the Tuatha'an, Elias, since you were with us last spring?
Perrin's eyes drifted open and half shut again.
No, Elias replied around his pipe stem. I don't like being around too many people at once.
Rain chuckled.
Especially people who live in a way so opposite to your own, eh? No, my old friend, don't worry. I gave up years ago hoping you would come to the way. But I have heard a story since last we met, and if you have not heard it yet, it might interest you. It interests me, and I have heard it again and again, every time we meet others of the people.
I'll listen.
It begins in the spring 2 years ago, with a band of the people who were crossing the waste by the northern route.
Perrin's eyes shot open.
The waste? The Aiel waste? They were crossing the Aiel waste?
Some people can enter the waste without being bothered, Elias said. Gleeman, peddlers, if they're honest. The Tuatha'an cross the waste all the time. Merchants from Cairhien used to, before the tree and the Aiel war.
The Aielmen avoid us, Rain said sadly.
though many of us have tried to speak with them. They watch us from a distance, but they will not come near us nor let us come near them. Sometimes I worry that they might know the song, though I suppose it isn't likely. Among Aiel, men do not sing, you know. Isn't that strange? From the time an Aiel boy becomes a man, he will not sing anything but battle chants or their dirge for the slain. I have heard them singing over their dead and over those they have killed. That song is one to make the stones weep.
Ila, listening, nodded agreement over her knitting. Perrin did some quick rethinking. He had thought the tinkers must be afraid all the time, with all this talk of running away. But no one who was afraid would even think of crossing the Aiel Waste. From what he had heard, no one who was sane would try crossing the waste.
"If this is some story about a song," Elias began, but Rain shook his head.
"No, my old friend, not a song. I am not sure I know what it is about."
He turned his attention to Perrin.
"Young Aiel often travel into the Blight. Some of the young men go alone, thinking for some reason that they have been called to kill the Dark One. Most go in small groups to hunt Trollocs."
Rain shook his head sadly, and when he went on, his voice was heavy.
"2 years ago, a band of the people crossing the waste about 100 miles south of the Blight found one of these groups." "Young women,"
Ila put in, as sorrowful as her husband.
"Little more than girls."
Perrin made a surprised sound, and Elias grinned at him wryly.
"You girls don't have to tend house and cook if they don't want to, boy. The ones who want to be warriors instead join one of the warrior societies. Far Darai's Mai, the Maidens of the Spear, and fight right alongside the men."
Perrin shook his head. Elias chuckled at his expression. Rain took up the story again, distaste and perplexity mingled in his voice.
"The young women were all dead, except one, and she was dying. She crawled to the wagons. It was clear she knew they were to Atha'an. Her loathing outweighed her pain, but she had a message so important to her that she must pass it on to someone, even us, before she died. Men went to see if they could help any of the others. There was a trail of her blood to follow, but all were dead, and so were 3 times their number in Trollocs."
Elias sat up, his pipe almost falling from between his teeth.
100 miles into the waste? Impossible! Javik Kashar!
That's what Trollocs call the waste.
The dying ground. They wouldn't go 100 miles into the waste if all the Murdrol and the Blight were driving them.
"You know an awful lot about Trollocs, Elias," Perrin said.
"Go on with your story," Elias told Rain gruffly.
"From trophies the Aiel carried, it was obvious they were coming back from the Blight. The Trollocs had followed, but by the tracks only a few lived to return after killing the Aiel. As for the girl, she would not let anyone touch her, even to tend her wounds. But she seized the seeker of that band by his coat. And this is what she said, word for word. Leaf Blighter means to blind the eye of the world, lost one. He means to slay the great serpent. Warn the people, lost one. Sightburner comes. Tell them to stand ready for he who comes with the dawn. Tell them." And then she died. "Leaf Blighter and Sight Burner," Rain added to Perrin, "are Aiel names for the Dark One. But I don't understand another word of it. Yet she thought it important enough to approach those she obviously despised, to pass it on with her last breath. But to who? We are ourselves the people, but I hardly think she meant it for us. The Aiel? They would not let us tell them if we tried."
He sighed heavily.
"She called us the lost. I never knew before how much they loathe us."
Ila set her knitting in her lap and touched his head gently.
"Something they learned in the Blight," Elias mused, "but none of it makes sense. Slay the great serpent? Kill time itself? and blind the eye of the world? As well say he's going to starve a rock. Maybe she was babbling, Rain. Wounded, dying, she could have lost her grip on what was real. Maybe she didn't even know who those Tuathaan were.
She knew what she was saying, and to whom she was saying it. Something more important to her than her own life, and we cannot even understand it. When I saw you walking into our camp, I thought perhaps we would find the answer at last, since you were.
Elias made a quick motion with his hand, and Rain changed what he had been going to say.
Are a friend, and know many strange things.
Not about this, Elias said in a tone that put an end to talk.
The silence around the campfire was broken only by the music and laughter drifting from other parts of the night-shrouded camp. Lying with his shoulders propped on one of the logs around the fire, Perrin tried puzzling out the Aiel woman's message, but it made no more sense to him than it had to Rain or Elias.
The eye of the world. That had been in his dreams more than once, but he did not want to think about those dreams. Elias now. There was a question there he would like answered. What had Rain been about to say about the bearded man, and why had Elias cut him off? He had no luck with that either. He was trying to imagine what Aiel girls were like, going into the Blight where only warders went that he had ever heard, fighting Trollocs. When he heard Egwene coming back, singing to herself. Scrambling to his feet, he went to meet her at the edge of the firelight. She stopped short, looking at him with her head tilted to one side. In the dark, he could not read her expression.
"You've been gone a long time," he said. "Did you have fun?"
"We ate with his mother," she answered, "and then we danced and laughed. It seems like forever since I danced."
"He reminds me of Will Alcin. You always had sense enough not to let Will put you in his pocket."
"Aram is a gentle boy who is fun to be with," she said in a tight voice. "He makes me laugh."
Perrin sighed.
"I'm sorry. I'm glad you had fun dancing."
Abruptly, she flung her arms around him, weeping on his shirt. Awkwardly, he patted her hair.
Rand would know what to do, he thought.
Rand had an easy way with girls. Not like him, who never knew what to do or say.
"I told you I'm sorry, Egwene. I really am glad you had fun dancing, really."
"Tell me they're alive," she mumbled into his chest.
"What?" She pushed back to arm's length, her hands on his arms, and looked up at him in the darkness.
"Rand and Matt, the others, tell me they are alive."
He took a deep breath and looked around uncertainly.
"They are alive," he said finally.
"Good."
She scrubbed at her cheeks with quick fingers.
"That is what I wanted to hear. Good night, Perrin. Sleep well."
Standing on tiptoe, she brushed a kiss across his cheek and hurried past him before he could speak. He turned to watch her. Ela rose to meet her, and the two women went into the wagon talking quietly.
"Rand might understand it," he thought, "but I don't."
In the distant night, the wolves howled the first thin sliver of the new moon toward the horizon, and he shivered. Tomorrow would be time enough to worry about the wolves again. He was wrong. They were waiting to greet him in his dreams.